Hey, everybody, I'm excited about our conversation today. We've got Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy coming in to talk to us about the latest happenings in Congress, particularly around the debt negotiations and some of the things that have been going on behind the scenes with China, for example. Really excited about that. He is in his fourth term representing Illinois' 8th congressional district, which includes Chicago's west and northwest suburbs, for those of you from the Chicago area, as well as the 41st ward of the city. So he's got the suburbs in the city, so he has an idea of how all this looks and sounds on the street. He serves as a ranking member of the Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party, hence talking about China. We get into all kinds of goodies, not just the debt ceiling or his work on the Select Committee with respect to China, but also this idea of how we go about and reaffirm our commitment to democracy in the face of so many efforts to undermine that commitment. So get ready to join me and Congressman Krishnamoorthy coming up right here on the Michael Steele podcast right after this. Hey, everybody. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We pulled this brother off the floor. So they're in the middle of some votes, and it's such a great opportunity to have the congressman come in and spend some time with us. Welcome, Raja. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast.
Hey, I'm very, very glad to be back. I think the last time was during the height of COVID. And so it's great to see you and great to see you're well too.
Yeah, no, man, I am blessed as I hope you are as well. And it just, there's a lot going on right now. You're positioned in many respects in a unique spot, given the work that you're doing in the Congress, elevating not just the common sense policy, but, you know, sort of the democracy point. We saw some of that play out during the recent discussion around the debt ceiling debate, watching Republicans sort of twist and turn themselves into many pretzels that eventually, to his credit, Kevin McCarthy was able to gather up and put in place. What's your take on that process, number one? And number two, the outcome. We cleared a hurdle for 24 months, or at least 18 to 24 months. We're not have to deal with this again, but we will have to deal with it again. So I'd like to get your thoughts also on, can we do this better going forward? But first, how did you evaluate the process and the outcome before we get into, can we do this better?
I think the outcome was as good as it could be under the circumstances. I think that you know, we'll talk about it in a second, but I think that we should not have a debt ceiling. I think that we should eliminate it once and for all and do what other countries normally do, which is, you know, once the Congress or the legislative body has made spending decisions, then the executive branch has to do whatever it takes to execute those spending decisions. Do we have a debt and deficit problem? Absolutely. And as a small business person, I'm the first to argue that we have to get our deficits and our overall debt under control. But, you know, putting ourselves in a position where we're basically holding taxpayers hostage, so security recipients, military veterans, people with savings in the stock market, hostage to negotiations that, you know, basically just nearly averted a crisis, is really not the way to go. In this particular situation, I think Kevin McCarthy had a very large proportion of his caucus who were never going to vote for any kind of debt deal whatsoever. And what I like to say is a bunch of them are part of the vote no, hope yes caucus. They are very cynical, Michael. They know that they can vote no, because a lot of people can vote are going to be voting yes, and are going to be passing the bill and getting it signed into law while they can make their rhetorical points. And that's very unfortunate. That's just not the way, in my opinion, you know, the train should be run around here in Washington.
Yeah, I agree with you 1,000% there. The political posturing around this issue it just knows no bounds, and it's gotten worse. I mean, you go back and you look at that, and I really pressed this during the height of this discussion over the last 10 to 12 days before the vote, that, you know, Democrats, when they were in the position that Republicans found themselves in during the Trump administration, stood with the country three times and gave the Republican president and the Republican Senate the votes they needed, a clean debt bill, not just in 17, but again in 18 and again in 19. And now that the tables turn, you watch all of a sudden these so-called fiscal conservatives who had up to that point spent $8 trillion that they did not, they could not account for in the country's budget. Oh, my bad. We haven't passed a budget in 20 years, but okay, I set that aside. They now seem to find this new space to argue against a clean debt limit, against giving Joe Biden the tools he needed to get us past the moment so that we affirm stability in the market, not shake the markets. And it led me to believe something you've already addressed, which is, why are we doing this way? We are the only nation outside of Denmark. And Denmark, as you know, Congressman, has set their debt limit so high, they will never reach it. They will never reach the number, right? But we do. We not only reach it, surpass it. And I get the spending argument on the other side. So let's, one, pass the nation's budget, because the budget will force you to address spending, not the debt discussion, the budget. And two, let's eliminate this process. I agree with you 1,000%. Let's just get rid of this whole debt ceiling game, and stop having it used as a political tool against the opposition party that has no effect on the opposition party, quite honestly, but has a greater effect on the economies of small business owners, moms and pops out there who got money tied up in the markets and the markets themselves. What say you?
I agree with you. I was actually getting texts, you know, leading up to the final vote, basically where, you know, a mom or a dad was texting me saying, look, you know, my kid is about to go to college. And, you know, I think I better just pull all my money out at this point, right, out of the market, so that his tuition money or her tuition money is not going to go down the tubes because you guys can't do your job in Washington. And, you know, that's just one example of how, you know, what happens in Washington has real world consequences for ordinary people. And so we have to change the way that we do business here.
One final question on the debt quite on point is, do you see any movement in the House among a group of Democrats and Republicans who would come together to put a bill on the floor or put a bill before a committee, or just get the bill, a possible bill discussed that would eliminate this debt ceiling game and tie it to sound fiscal policy around doing the congressionally constitutionally mandated job of providing the nation with a budget before September 30th?
No. I'm sorry.
Well, at least you're honest.
I have not seen a Republican. I've not seen Republicans line up behind that. You know, as you know, for whatever reason, this whole debt ceiling thing has become a cudgel, and it is a way for folks on the other side to both bash a Democratic president, and also to make a cultural statement to their base, even if they, again, hope like hell that the debt ceiling gets raised and that the markets don't crater and that the economy doesn't go to pot. So, so far, I haven't seen serious legislation along the lines of what you're saying, although I think in the future it's going to come up again, if for no other reason than Democrats. I think Democrats are probably going to take back the House and hopefully maintain control of the Senate.
Well, if you do that, and there is a Joe Biden sitting in the White House with a Chuck Schumer in the Senate, then I would recommend that be a bill put on the table and passed and signed, because otherwise it won't happen. It's going to take one of the parties in the majority to actually force the issue. It's going to take that party forcing the national debate, because you know there will be a lot of noise from the opposition. And to educate the country on the nation's fiscal health, how the process works. That way you avoid the stupid in the future. Just a thought. Just a thought.
How about that? Avoid stupid. I like that.
Avoid stupid. So, but Congressman, there is one area where, again, you're at the tip of the spear on this, where there is some bipartisanship that's rearing, fortunately, rearing its head. And that is the work that you're doing on the House Select Committee on China. You're the ranking member there. You are working with Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, who's a good guy. I've known Mike a while. Give us a little bit of an insight of the work of the committee. You know, educate us a little bit about what a select committee is versus all the other committees. And how does this bipartisan moment work? Actually work, where Republicans and Democrats at least have some sense of how to protect the U.S. economic interest as well as our strategic and national security and technological interests against China?
Well, it's really interesting. I think that, Michael, I'm really very pleased with how Chairman Gallagher and I have been able to work together closely, along with our leadership, for that matter, Speaker McCarthy and Hakeem Jeffries, in trying to make sure that this committee is focused on getting things done. I remember the first meeting of the committee. Actually, Kevin McCarthy and Hakeem Jeffries were there to address us. And I remember Speaker McCarthy said, you know, if you want to engage in partisanship, I've got committees for that. and then he said, you know, if you want to get something done on one of the, you know, most important issues facing our country, then this is the committee where we're gonna get it done. And so, you know, Mike and I have taken that to heart. We just issued our first set of legislative recommendations the other day. One is with regard to deterring aggression with regard to Taiwan. The other has to do with enforcing our laws against slave labor and the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. As you know, there's a genocide going on against the Uyghur people in Xinjiang province of China. Mm-hmm. And we have laws that try to prevent the slave labor that's employed in Xinjiang, and specifically against the Uyghur people, from contaminating supply chains in the United States. And so we're trying to enforce that and at the same time combat the genocide. We're trying to work in a way, Michael, that respects our differences, mm-hmm. but also builds on where we share views in common. And then we think we can get legislation done to effectuate that.
I'm glad you mentioned it, because I was going to ask you, what makes this work? I mean, given, I love the way you started it off by saying, hey, you know, the leadership is like, well, if you want to do partisan stuff, we got a lot of committees for that. There's no shortage. But if you want to get something done, then this is the space to do it. Part of that is, I think, a recognition, at least from my experience over these many years working with members, is the leadership plays a big role in setting that term, that tone relative to bipartisanship. Bipartisanship exists only to the extent that the leadership allows it to exist, quite honestly. Having said that, it also boils down to the relationship between you, if you're the ranking member or if you're the chairman of the committee, and the other party, in this case, Mike Gallagher, the Republican from Wisconsin. What makes that work for you before you even got into the nitty gritty of, oh yeah, let's talk about China, that personalization piece? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's a great point. Mike and I came into Congress together. And so we've known each other a long time. We actually started a caucus together called the Middle Class Jobs Caucus when we first entered Congress. So we have a relationship and a friendship that kind of, in my opinion, helps to be the glue between us so that we can be honest with each other. And we can trust each other. That's very important around here. And as you know, Michael, in politics, one of the reasons why partisanship exists, or I should say bipartisanship doesn't exist as much as it should, is because a lot of people feel like if they were to actually show a vulnerability, if they were to be honest with the other side, if they were to say what they really thought about something, they fear that it would get used against them. And somehow it would be used politically against them, whether it was used within their party or by someone from the other party. So, you know, Mike and I think are able to kind of talk with each other freely so that we can brainstorm and figure out, okay, what are some areas where, it makes sense on your side. It makes sense on my side. Let's pursue those first.
We're having a great little inside conversation with my buddy, member of Congress, ranking member of the Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party, Raja Krishnamurthy. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to get a little bit more into maybe a little TikTok and some other things that the congressman is working on right after this.
If you like this podcast, make sure you check out The Warning with me, Steve Schmidt. Several times a week, I'll be joined by fantastic guests, some household names, some world famous, and some great and interesting people you may never have heard of, to discuss the political and cultural currents that are shaping our times, as well as the unseen forces driving politics that are rarely, if ever, discussed on cable news. You can find it wherever you listen and download your podcasts from.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. So this is just sort of getting a little background understanding of some of the recent happenings on Capitol Hill with my buddy, Raja Krishnamurthy, who is a member of Congress. So Raja, let's talk about TikTok. I've been straight up about this. I've been in the public space so long. Anything the Chinese want to know about me, they already got. So I'm like, okay, whatever. I'm a fan. I like it. And my wife, which at late at night, when I come upstairs, she said, I heard you down there laughing. I heard you down there giggling, because I was on TikTok and just looking at crazy, silly Americans doing, you know, stupid human pet tricks or whatever. But it's fun. But I also take it seriously, and I do appreciate the concerns that you have raised. All legitimate concerns. You've been a strong advocate for banning TikTok. We've now seen some states follow your lead on that and begin to put in state bans on TikTok. Do you see more states doing that? And B, could you explain to folks what it is that rubs you the rawest? What is your biggest concern with what the Chinese? Because I get it. I'm not buying this whole thing. Oh, the Chinese government has nothing to do with it. We're just an independent Chinese company that exists in communist China. Yeah, okay. I don't buy that. But
yeah,
the floor is yours, sir, on that one, because I think it's important for people to understand why members like yourself are really exercised about this legitimately.
So I don't necessarily want to ban TikTok. I don't want to see it go dark, but I do want to see the ownership structure change so that it's not owned by a company, namely ByteDance, that is beholden to the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. And what do I mean by that? There are two laws in China that are very concerning. One is the National Intelligence Law, which requires that ByteDance basically provide user data at the CCP's request on anybody, any user, anywhere in the world, including the United States. And there are 150 million American users. Mm-hmm. So that means location data, could mean credit card data, it could be personal identifiable information, it could be any of those. And it turns out that on the Chinese version of TikTok, they use that routinely to surveil their own citizens. That's what happens. Okay. The second concern is the CCP is embedded within TikTok. They have a cell within every private company in China, including ByteDance. And basically that cell has as its general secretary, the editor-in-chief of ByteDance.
Right.
That guy said that he's going to make sure all of their products adhere to quote unquote correct political attitudes. So what does that mean? They control the algorithm. So they suppress voices that are critical of the CCP. They call it heating, which means they promote those voices and those viewpoints that are pleasant or that are
supportive, right?
And so they basically shape the news. They shape the content in a way that is very disturbing. I was listening last night to a commentator, and I understand that Americans should be able to hear whatever news or whatever information right. they'd like. But the problem with social media and this platform in particular is you just don't know. It's not like the CCP is going to say, and this message brought to you by the CCP. This is
right.
from the CCP.
That would help. That would
from
help.
Beijing. Right. No, that's not how it works.
So let me ask you this, Congressman. How is that different from Elon Musk? Because in my view, it's the same outcome. It's just, you know, whether it is sort of softening communism and the authoritarianism of China and Xi Jinping, or softening white nationalism and the authoritarianism of a rogue populist Republican Party, which the irony is not lost on me that in this short period of time that a platform like Twitter has gone from what it was to now the place that conservatives are like, oh, we got to protect Twitter. We got to defend Elon Musk. I'm like, what the, you know what? So it would tell me the difference, because I don't see any. So because I would be just as exercised about Elon Musk as I would be China, or China as I should be about Elon Musk.
Sure. So there are let me just tackle the two big issues that I see in what you said. One is, you're absolutely right. Social media companies such as Twitter, whether they are based here or abroad, certainly here, need to be better regulated so that we don't have to deal with potential misinformation, disinformation, or other types of content, which is potentially dangerous to our body politic. I think that is one of the reasons why, for instance, I believe that we have to review Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which provides a safe harbor, a loophole, a place where they are immune from any liability associated with their content. That right. is wrong. Okay, so that's point number one. I think we absolutely have to do that. But point two is that, believe it or not, what ByteDance and TikTok have right now is not only all the concerns that you brought up with regard to Elon Musk, but on top of that, you have an adversarial regime that can use the platform in a way to endanger our national security. We're not talking about just any old regime. We're talking about the CCP, which has you know, it's designed on kind of basically ends or outcomes that are really at odds with what we currently want in the United States. We're talking about a regime that, you know, where Xi Jinping has, he's the general secretary of the right. party. He has said repeatedly that, you know, he wants to make sure that the CCP becomes the leading national, leading international power, displacing the United States. He wants to see us and our position erode. And so this is a very different situation.
How does the China, the Chinese balloon incident, the TikTok question, impact the relationship between Xi Jinping and President Biden, whom they will be meeting at some point? And so I suspect, or do you hope that these topics will be covered? Number one, and then number two, how should Americans look at the Chinese? And particularly when you're looking at, again, something like TikTok, we're willing to go out, watch our government go out and, you know, go after the Chinese for all the things that they do wrong. But we're not prepared as a country, that same government is not prepared to deal with the forms of domestic terrorism that are occurring here at home from January 6th onward. So how do these events shape this relationship between the two presidents and the people?
So first of all, our quarrel is not with the Chinese people. We, in fact, you know, we said in our opening statements at the hearing, our first hearing on the select committee, that oftentimes Chinese nationals are the victims of the repression of the CCP. They are not the ones that we should be picking a fight with. That being said, we have to safeguard our interests. We have to safeguard our values. We have to deter aggression, and we have to up our game, Michael. Mm-hmm. What I mean by upping our game is we have to fix those things in the United States that are wrong with our own governance, that hold our people back in the global competition with the CCP, whether it's upgrading the skills of our workforce so that they can compete in the 21st century, investing in technologies of the future like AI, quantum computing, robotics, and so forth, or fixing our legal immigration system, which is completely screwed up, right, which prevents us from retaining and attracting those people that are necessary for outcompeting the CCP. So I think President Biden, in meeting with Xi Jinping, has to figure out with Xi Jinping, how do we put a floor under the relationship so that we don't go into a cold war, God forbid, a hot war, any open hostilities. We put guardrails in the relationship so that it doesn't veer off course, so that, for instance, Chinese aircraft aren't cutting in front of our jets on routine patrol in the South China Sea, risking a major international incident.
Right, as we just saw, right. And in Taiwan, Taiwan, I presume, would be another one of those guardrails that we'd have to talk about.
So that's what I think he has to kind of focus on. I think the spy balloon incident was very unfortunate, to say the least, but it kind of points out to me how a lack of dialogue, a lack of communication can lead to grave miscalculation. And then nobody's better off when that happens.
I know you got to get ready to go back to floor votes, folks. I do want to grab one last domestic political question for you, because that's always fun and it's what I do.
Of course.
I know a little bit about that. On the Republican side, you've got a former president likely to be indicted again by Jack Smith's impaneled jury, a grand jury in Florida. You've got Joe Biden, who recently had a mishap at graduation ceremonies in which he tripped over a sandbag and fell. But everyone thinks, oh, my God, see, he's so damn old. We can't, you know, we can't possibly. And that's just Democrats. It's not Republicans. That's just Democrats. How do you see this potential presidential race shaping up from your perspective? Yeah, I know which team you're on. I know what you're playing. That's really not the point. I'm just trying to get a sense from you. Where do you think this thing settles down? And how does it settle down? Chris Christie and others jumping in the race now. And what all that potentially could look like come September, October of this year, going into next year?
It's a great question. I think that, let me just put it in these terms. I think the American people want to have team normal in place, helping to run the country. And they do not want team extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that whether I'm talking about Democrats or moderate Republicans or independents, they desperately want team normal so that they don't have to worry that somebody's going to take decisions that could really screw up their lives on an everyday basis. When I think about it that way, I think that in the final analysis, I think President Biden is going to be evaluated relative to whoever he's competing against. And so therefore, I don't think you can look at him like in a vacuum. I think it's going to be a comparison. And I think people are going to credit him for his bipartisan accomplishments, whether it's the CHIPS and Science Act or the Safer Communities Act, the first, you know, gun control in a long time, or the bipartisan infrastructure bill. I think it's up to us in Congress, and for that matter, in government, to implement those bills in a way that helps people improve their lives, so that they really see that this legislation actually has positive consequences, and that we see inflation going down, that the economy is steady, that job growth continues. If all that happens, then I think Joe Biden is in good shape. On the Republican side, I don't know what's going to happen, honestly. I think that each time I see Donald Trump get indicted, it seems like his poll ratings go up in the Republican presidential primary. And ironically, it feels like his competitors have to rally to his cause. It's a bizarre situation where they are. I think I talked earlier in your podcast about the vote no, hope yes.
All right.
And I think in this context, it's like, hope no, say yes to Donald Trump. I mean, it's just a crazy situation that I see popping up in the Republican primary. But that's how I see it. I think at the end of the day, Michael, this is my fourth term in Congress. I knocked on a lot of doors in the last contest because I was introducing myself to a heck of a lot of people in my new congressional district. And I just saw that people want, predictable government. They don't want people talking about, relitigating elections. They don't want to talk about, all of a sudden, reproductive rights kind of being turned upside down. They don't want to talk about banning books and, they don't want to talk about a lot of the things that seem to take up a lot of the oxygen right now.
Yeah, the culture war piece is I think it's a dangerous piece because it is designed first and foremost to pit Americans against Americans.
That's right.
It's not designed about conversation or understanding, whether you're talking about transgenderism, whether you're talking about the abortion issue, whether you're talking about what our kids are learning in classrooms. As I noted recently on MSNBC, a lot of these parents who are out here screaming and shouting have never been to a school board meeting. And the first time they're screaming and shouting is literally the first time they've been at a school board meeting. And the reason they're there is because they saw something on Facebook that said that their kid was being taught transgenderism that would require them to pay black folks reparations because white people are responsible for fill in the blank. And then that mom goes to her first school board meeting and standing there, and the proof is in the pudding of the over 1,100 books that have been banned across the country, and certainly in states like Florida, that's been the work of 11 people, not 1,100, not 11,000, not 110,000, 11 people.
At some level, I think we should be trying to ban illiteracy, right?
You would think.
Banning, you know, how about banning what ails us in society instead of those things that are kind of lifting us up? And, you know, I was at a pride parade this weekend. Happy Pride to all of your listeners.
Happy Pride, yeah.
Celebrating. And I couldn't tell you how happy people were to be able to celebrate each other and to basically live out that most important virtue of America, which is equality. Equality. I cannot tell you how that resonates with so many people across the ideological spectrum when you talk about this virtue and how we need to hold it up and how our young people need to see that being held up. And if we can do that more and we can talk about it, I still feel confident we'll get through this latest culture war. But man, it would sure help for us to solve some other problems around here too.
It would. And that's why we're glad you're in the Congress, my friend, to do that. It has been a treat for me to get to know you over these last few years, especially to see your work, to be on air with you from time to time and have these conversations and to welcome you back to the Michael Steele podcast. It's always a treat. I love the insight. I know my listeners do as well. And I just appreciate you, brother, because I know it's not easy.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you and all your great work. And you're trying to bring people together and trying to get people onto Team Normal and to stay on Team Normal.
Team Normal. Amen. Amen. Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy, thank you so much for coming back to the Michael Steele podcast. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to spend with us and to listen to the words of the congressman. Do follow his good work on Capitol Hill on Twitter at Congressman Raja, R-A-J-A. Certainly check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele and the podcast at Steele_podcast. Do that download thing because it makes me feel all yummy inside. And until now that summer's here officially, I'm going to go work on my tan. Until then, be blessed, be well, and we'll talk soon.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.